File 27.
The manner in which the great rival of the Pan-German Party set out to attain its goal was quite different. The way it took was well and shrewdly chosen, but it did not have a clear vision of the goal. In almost all the questions where the Pan-German movement failed, the policy of the Christian Socialist Party was correct and systematic. They assessed the importance of the masses correctly, and thus they gained the support of large numbers of the popular masses by emphasizing the social character of the movement from the very start. By directing their appeal especially to the lower middle class and the artisans, they gained adherents who were faithful, persevering, and self-sacrificing. The Christian socialist leaders took care to avoid all controversy with the institutions of religion, and thus they secured the support of that mighty organization, the Catholic Church. Those leaders recognized the value of propaganda on a large scale, and they were veritable virtuosos in working up the spiritual instincts of the broad masses of their adherents. The failure of this party to carry into effect the dream of saving Austria from dissolution must be attributed to two main defects in the means they employed, and also the lack of a clear perception of the ends they wished to reach. The anti-Semitism of the Christian socialists was based on religious instead of racial principles. The reason for this mistake gave rise to the second error also. The founders of the Christian Socialist Party were of the opinion that they could not base their position on the racial principle if they wished to save Austria, because they felt that a general disintegration of the state might quickly result from the adoption of such a policy. In the opinion of the party chiefs, the situation in Vienna demanded that all factors which tended to estrange the nationalists from one another should be carefully avoided, and that all factors making for unity should be encouraged. At that time, Vienna was so honeycombed with foreign elements, especially the Czechs, that the greatest amount of tolerance was necessary if these elements were to be enlisted in the ranks of any party that was not anti-German on principle. If Austria was to be saved, those elements were indispensable. And so attempts were made to win the support of the small traders, a great number of whom were Czechs, by combating the liberalism of the Manchester School, and they believed that by adopting this attitude they had found a slogan against Jewry, which, because of its religious implications, would unite all the different nationalities which made up the population of the old Austria. It was obvious, however, that this kind of anti-Semitism did not upset the Jews very much, simply because it had a purely religious foundation. If the worst came to the worst, a few drops of baptismal water would settle the matter. Hereupon the Jew could still carry on his business safely, and at the same time retain his Jewish nationality. On such superficial grounds, it was impossible to deal with the whole problem in an earnest and rational way. The consequence was that many people could not understand this kind of anti-Semitism, and therefore refused to take part in it. The attractive force of the idea was thus restricted exclusively to narrow-minded circles, because the leaders failed to go beyond the mere emotional appeal and did not ground their position on a truly rational basis. The intellectuals were opposed to such a policy on principle. It looked more and more as if the whole movement was a new attempt to proselytize the Jews, or, on the other hand, as if it were merely organized from the wish to compete with other contemporary movements. Thus the struggle lost all traces of having been organized for a spiritual and sublime mission. Indeed, it seemed to some people, and these were by no means worthless elements, to be immoral and reprehensible. The movement failed to awaken a belief that there was a problem of vital importance for the whole of humanity, and on the solution of which the destiny of the whole Gentile world depended. Through this shilly-shally way of dealing with the problem, the anti-Semitism of the Christian socialists turned out to be quite ineffective. It was anti-Semitic only in outward appearance, and this was worse than if it had made no pretense at all to anti-Semitism. For the pretense gave rise to a false sense of security among people who believed that the enemy had been taken by the ears. But as a matter of fact, the people themselves were being led by the nose. The Jew readily adjusted himself to this form of anti-Semitism and found its continuance more profitable to him than its abolition would be. This whole movement led to great sacrifices being made for the sake of that state which was composed of many heterogeneous nationalities, but much greater sacrifices had to be made by the trustees of the German element. One did not dare to be nationalist, even in Vienna, lest the ground should fall away from under one's feet. It was hoped that the Habsburg state might be saved by a silent evasion of the nationalist question, but this policy led that state to ruin. The same policy also led to the collapse of Christian socialism, for thus the movement was deprived of the only source of energy from which a political party can draw the necessary driving force. During those years, I carefully followed the two movements and observed how they developed, one because my heart was with it, and the other because of my admiration for that remarkable man who then appeared to me as a bitter symbol of the whole German population in Austria. When the imposing funeral cortege of the dead Burgomaster wound its way from the city hall towards the Ringstrasse, I stood among the hundreds of thousands who watched the solemn procession pass by. As I stood there, I felt deeply moved, and my instinct clearly told me that the work of this man was all in vain, because a sinister fate was inexorably leading this state to its downfall. If Dr. Karl Luger had lived in Germany, he would have been ranked among the great leaders of our people. It was a misfortune for his work and for himself that he had to live in this impossible state. When he died, the fire had already been enkindled in the Balkans and was spreading month by month. Fate had been merciful in sparing him the sight of what, even to the last, he had hoped to prevent. I endeavoured to analyse the cause which rendered one of those movements futile and wrecked the process of the other. The result of this investigation was the profound conviction that, apart from the inherent impossibility of consolidating the position of the state in the old Austria, the two parties made the following fatal mistake. The Pan-German Party was perfectly right in its fundamental ideas regarding the aim of the movement, which was to bring about a German restoration, but it was unfortunate in the choice of means. It was nationalist, but unfortunately it paid too little heed to the social problem, and thus it failed to gain the support of the masses. Its anti-Jewish policy, however, was grounded on a correct perception of the significance of the racial problem, and not on religious principles. But it was mistaken in its assessment of facts, and adopted the wrong tactics when it made war against one of the religious denominations. The Christian Socialist movement had only a vague concept of a German revival as part of its object, but it was intelligent and fortunate in the choice of means to carry out its policy as a party. The Christian Socialists grasped the significance of the social question, but they adopted the wrong principles in their struggle against Jewry, and they utterly failed to appreciate the value of the national idea as a source of political energy. If the Christian Socialist Party, together with its shrewd judgment in regard to the worth of the popular masses, had only judged rightly also on the importance of the racial problem, which was properly grasped by the Pan-German movement, and if this party had been really nationalist, or if the Pan-German leaders, on the other hand, in addition to their correct judgment of the Jewish problem and of the national idea, had adopted the practical wisdom of the Christian Socialist Party, and particularly their attitude towards socialism, then a movement would have developed which, in my opinion, might at that time have successfully altered the course of German destiny. If things did not turn out thus, the fault lay for the most part in the inherent nature of the Austrian state. I did not find my own convictions upheld by any party then in existence, and so I could not bring myself to enlist as a member in any of the existing organizations, or even lend a hand in their struggle. Even at that time, all those organizations seemed to me to be already jaded in their energies, and were therefore incapable of bringing about a national revival of the German people in a really profound way, not merely outwardly. My inner aversion to the Habsburg state was increasing daily. The more I paid special attention to questions of foreign policy, the more the conviction grew upon me that this phantom state would surely bring misfortune on the Germans. I realized more and more that the destiny of the German nation could not be decisively influenced from here, but only in the German Empire itself. And this was true not only in regard to general political questions, but also, and in no less a degree, in regard to the whole sphere of cultural life. Here also, in matters affecting the national culture and art, the Austrian state showed all the signs of senile decrepitude, or at least it was ceasing to be of any consequence to the German nation, as far as these matters were concerned. This was especially true of its architecture. Modern architecture could not produce any great results in Austria, because since the building of the Ringstrasse, at least in Vienna, architectural activities had become insignificant when compared with the progressive plans which were being thought out in Germany. And so I came more and more to lead what may be called a twofold existence. Reason and reality forced me to continue my harsh apprenticeship in Austria, though I must now say that this apprenticeship turned out fortunate in the end. But my heart was elsewhere. A feeling of discontent grew upon me, and made me depressed the more I came to realize the inside hollowness of this state, and the impossibility of saving it from collapse. At the same time, I felt perfectly certain that it would bring all kinds of misfortune to the German people. I was convinced that the Habsburg state would balk and hinder every German who might show signs of real greatness, while at the same time It would aid and abet every non-German activity. This conglomerate spectacle of heterogeneous races, which the capital of the dual monarchy presented, this motley of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Serbs and Croats, etc., and always that bacillus which is the solvent of human society, the Jew, here and there and everywhere, the whole spectacle was repugnant to me. The gigantic city seemed to be the incarnation of mongrel depravity. The German language, which I had spoken from the time of my boyhood, was the vernacular idiom of Lower Bavaria. I never forgot that particular style of speech, and I could never learn the Viennese dialect. The longer I lived in that city, the stronger became my hatred for the promiscuous swarm of foreign peoples which had begun to batten on that old nursery ground of German culture. The idea that this state could maintain its further existence for any considerable time was quite absurd. Austria was then like a piece of ancient mosaic, in which the cohesive cement had dried up and become old and friable. As long as such a work of art remains untouched, it may hold together and continue to exist. But the moment some blow is struck on it, then it breaks up into thousands of fragments. Therefore, it was now only a question of when the blow would come. Because my heart was always with the German Empire and not with the Austrian monarchy, the hour of Austria's dissolution as a state appeared to me as only the first step towards the emancipation of the German nation. All these considerations intensified my yearning to depart for that country for which my heart had been secretly longing since the days of my youth. I hoped that one day I might be able to make my mark as an architect, and that I could devote my talents to the service of my country on a large or small scale, according to the will of fate. A final reason was that I longed to be among those who lived and worked in that land from which the movement should be launched, the object of which would be the fulfilment of what my heart had always longed for, namely, the union of the country in which I was born with our common fatherland, the German Empire. There are many who may not understand how such a yearning can be so strong, but I appeal especially to two groups of people. The first includes all those who are still denied the happiness I have spoken of, and the second embraces those who once enjoyed that happiness, but had it torn from them by a harsh fate. I turn to all those who have been torn from their motherland, and who have to struggle for the preservation of their most sacred patrimony, their native language, persecuted and harried because of their loyalty and love for the homeland, yearning sadly for the hour when they will be allowed to return to the bosom of their father's household. To these I address my words, and I know that they will understand. Only he who has experienced in his own inner life what it means to be German, and yet to be denied the right of belonging to his fatherland, can appreciate the profound nostalgia which that enforced exile causes. It is a perpetual heartache, and there is no place for joy and contentment until the doors of paternal home are thrown open and all those through whose veins kindred blood is flowing will find peace and rest in their common Reich. Vienna was a hard school for me, but it taught me the most profound lessons of my life. I was scarcely more than a boy when I came to live there, and when I left, I had grown to be a man of a grave and pensive nature. In Vienna, I acquired the foundations of a Weltanschauung in general, and developed a faculty for analysing political questions in particular. That Weltanschauung and the political ideas that formed have never been abandoned, though they were expanded later on in some directions. It is only now that I can fully appreciate how valuable those years of apprenticeship were for me. That is why I have given a detailed account of this period. There, in Vienna, stark reality taught me the truths that now form the fundamental principles of the party, which, within the course of 5 years, has grown from modest beginnings to a great mass movement. I do not know what my attitude towards Jewry, social democracy, or rather Marxism in general, to the social problem, etc., would be today, if I had not acquired a stock of personal beliefs at such an early age, by dint of hard study, and under the duress of fate. For, although the misfortunes of the fatherland may have stimulated thousands and thousands to ponder over the inner causes of the collapse, that could not lead to such a thorough knowledge and deep insight as a man may develop, who has fought a hard struggle for many years, so that he might be master of his own fate.